they would see a convicted Trump as unfit is an encouraging sign for Biden. The reality is that we're likely to have a very, very close November election. And when you get down to it, on both sides, it's going to be an issue of mobilization. And I think Trump will have perhaps some trouble mobilizing the whole of his Republican and conservative base. But Biden also will have trouble in that regard. And so we've got a long, complicated, and frankly, pretty frustrating race ahead of us.
And we're going to have to leave it there. And Nikki Haley is pouring money into new ads where she refers to the Trump-Biden nightmare. John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent, speaking to us from Wisconsin, just back from Iowa. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, February 17th from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. for a special live remote broadcast of Keep Alive the Dream. Keep Alive the Dream is an annual celebration of the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This year's event includes guest speakers and musical performances from the MLK All-Star Band, Eli Hardy, and more. Again, that's a special live broadcast of Keep Alive the Dream, Saturday, February 17th, from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, January 22nd at 4:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online via a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland metro area braces for another bout of winter weather. Lawmakers in Olympia float new ideas to address the issue of housing. And the Washington Attorney General takes aim at the Kroger-Albertsons merger. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 16, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. An ice storm warning is in effect for southwest Washington down through Oregon's Willamette Valley. This comes after a weekend of snow, ice, and wind through the greater Portland and Vancouver area. Ice accumulation throughout Wednesday morning could be nearly half an inch in the metro area. The National Weather Service says more falling trees and power outages are likely because of the ice storm. Over the weekend, over 150,000 people were impacted by power outages. As of the time of broadcast, Portland General Electric has brought that number down to some 30,000. Wednesday morning will bring temperatures that climb above freezing, and the ice and snow will begin to melt, but they'll leave behind a layer of thick slush for much of the day. Warming centers in the metro area are open again tonight. People can find a full list of Multnomah County warming centers online at multco.us/cold. Warming shelters in Multnomah County include Ascension Catholic Church, the Salvation Army on North Williams, Market Street Shelter, Cook Plaza in Gresham, Friendly House, Powell Shelter, and Freedom Foursquare Church. Folks can also warm up at the Multnomah County East Building in Gresham, the State of Oregon Building, Imago Dei Church, Bud Clark Commons, and Charles Jordan Community Center. No one will be turned away. The First Christian Church is closed because of a burst pipe. Multnomah County is urgently looking for more volunteers to help staff the warming shelters. Free transportation is available to warming shelters by calling 211, and TriMet rides to warming shelters are free. MAX lines are still suspended, and the buses replacing them often run behind schedule. The County Medical Examiner reports at least two people have died from suspected hypothermia so far. On Sunday, 24 county residents visited the emergency department for cold-related illnesses. By contrast, a normal day sees two or three. Washington State's legislative session is underway, and lawmakers are looking at the issue of housing as a big priority. One bill would limit rent increases to 5% per year. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Housing is a major issue in this year's legislative session, and for some, simply staying in their home is the goal. One measure in Olympia would help stabilize rent prices for tenants. In the first half of 2023, more than 6% of Washingtonians were forced to move because of rent increases. Deb Wilson lives in a manufactured home park in Aberdeen. In 2021, monthly rent on the land at the park was raised from $485 to $635. Wilson says that was a huge increase, especially for people on fixed incomes, and led to drastic changes in lifestyle for some.
They eat less meals per day. They don't buy all their medication, or they take less of their medication. They don't get to travel. So we're just sitting here waiting for people to dump dirt on us and bury us because we're just waiting to die.
House Bill 2114 would limit rent increases to 5% over a 12-month period and require landlords to give at least 6 months' notice if the rent increased by 3% or more. Opponents say the measure actually could limit housing supply because developers might be less inclined to build in the state. Wilson says the bill could keep people in their homes. She says if an increase is too much for someone, at least they would know what was coming.
We would be able to prepare to take our house and put it up for sale, to move our things to storage or sell them at a yard sale, something.
She believes rent stabilization is an important way to keep people housed.
If you don't want a humongous amount of homeless people, you need to keep people that are homed right now homed.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Washington State's Attorney General has sued to try to block the proposed merger of Kroger and Albertsons, the two biggest supermarkets in the U.S. In the lawsuit, Attorney General Bob Ferguson alleges that the potential $24.6 billion union would eliminate the rivalry that helps keep food prices down and would harm consumers and workers. He said that, quote, shoppers will have fewer choices and will pay higher prices at the grocery store, end quote. In Washington, the companies already own more than half of all supermarkets. Ohio-based Kroger and Idaho-based Albertsons argue they have to merge in order to compete with non-traditional rivals like Walmart, Amazon, and Costco. The companies wanted to finish the deal by last August. The Federal Trade Commission has been reviewing the proposed deal for more than a year. Various lawmakers and officials across the U.S. have been arguing that the merger would reduce options for shoppers, farmers, workers, and food producers, and would exacerbate issues on food accessibility in low-income communities. Lawmakers also say that the proposed store sell-off wouldn't resolve those problems. They cite examples from the previous Safeway-Albertsons merger, where communities were left without any grocery options at all after a similar sell-off. During the pandemic, Kroger increased executive compensation and bought back stock while laying off workers and closing various stores. The energy company PacifiCorp has renewed pledges to help bring salmon and other fish back to the Lewis River Basin in Washington by 2026, after previous failed promises. Farah Siddiqui spoke with Columbia Riverkeeper, who says they'll be watching to ensure this happens.
Coming into the new year, Columbia Riverkeeper is supporting efforts by the Cowlitz Tribe and Yakama Nation to restore salmon migration throughout the Lewis River. Fish passages would enable migration around dams and access to blocked habitats, essential for salmon and steelhead recovery in the culturally vital Lewis River Basin. Miles Johnson with the Columbia Riverkeeper says he's optimistic about a future of thriving fish and river wildlife.
We're tentatively pretty excited that we're going to see fish in parts of the Lewis River, which is a really important tributary of the Lower Columbia. We're going to see fish in places that they haven't been in many, many years.
PacifiCorp recently agreed to a new schedule to install fish passage at two of its hydroelectric dams on the Lewis. Johnson says Pacific Corps broke a previous promise to retrofit its dams to include fish passage, adding Columbia Riverkeeper will continue to hold it accountable for promises to tribes and the public. Johnson says Columbia Riverkeeper will also be watching the project carefully to ensure Pacific Corp follows through, given its past focus on financial interests over legal obligations.
These are really expensive projects to build, and Pacific Corp has demonstrated a history of putting its bottom line before its obligations to the fish and people who use the river.
Johnson adds, although things are in motion, until the fish passage facilities are built in a way that's meaningful and going to work, they will continue to monitor the process and, if necessary, try to hold Pacific Corps accountable. He adds, science shows that reconnecting fish with existing high-quality spawning habitat is the best way to recover the Lewis River's struggling populations of spring Chinook and coho salmon, steelhead, and bull trout. For Washington News Service, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
Nikki Haley hoped for a strong second-place finish in Iowa. Vice President Kamala Harris warns South Carolina voters their freedoms are under attack, and states move to limit the use of philanthropic funds to run elections. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We've just consistently seen the crowds grow and grow. Her poll numbers just continue to climb. She's obviously resonating with Iowans. Her message is really catching on.
Rachel Geilenfeld with Iowa Women for Nikki says former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has momentum. Early returns show former President Donald Trump dominating the Republican caucuses, but Haley's campaign aims for a strong second place before pivoting to New Hampshire next week, where she's doing well. Meanwhile, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis brushes off questions on whether his campaign has enough cash. He spent Monday warning Iowa voters that Trump is just in it for himself.
You can be the most worthless Republican in America, but if you kiss the ring, he'll say you're wonderful.
New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina polls all show DeSantis in single digits. The Texas National Guard is under fire for stopping the Border Patrol from aiding a woman and two children drowning in the Rio Grande. Governor Greg Abbott has clashed with the White House on immigration. The Senate may have reached a bipartisan border deal, but House Republicans say they won't consider any bill until Trump is reelected. That runs counter to what House Majority Leader Steve Scalise has repeatedly said.
I think the country has come a long way to recognizing this is one of the top issues, major threat to our national security. Joe Biden's the only one MIA on this.
House Republicans have passed strict limits on asylum, which stalled in the Senate. Vice President Kamala Harris marked MLK Day in South Carolina, urging black voters to push back against extremists working to undermine their civil rights.
They passed laws to ban drop boxes, limit early voting, and restrict absentee ballots.
South Carolina lawmakers tightened rules on absentee ballots so only those over 64 can get them. 16-year-olds can now pre-register to vote in Illinois. A growing list of blue states aim to make voting a habit for younger people. Illinois Secretary of State Alexi Giannoulias says they're simplifying the process.
You basically don't have to do anything except for get your driver's license. So it's eliminating one step, it's eliminating the work.
Meanwhile, a new law in Idaho says students can no longer use college IDs to register or vote. And 27 states now limit the use of philanthropic money to run elections. Private funds helped cover mail-in ballots and health rules during the pandemic. Opponents say grants could give the funders undue influence. But North Carolina Board of Elections Director Karen Brisson Bell says their legislature isn't budgeting enough for new ID rules or cybersecurity.
It is really going unrecognized at all levels of how complex it has become to conduct elections, to be election administrators, and to pay those folks adequately for their work.
Like many, the state has seen an exodus of election workers. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The January 6th insurrection in the U.S. Capitol is an example of what leading disinformation scholars call networked incitement, the use of social media by influential figures to create political violence. As Catherine Carley reports, court documents of people arrested that day reveal the power of unregulated social media and its potential threat to U.S. democracy.
The use of social media to organize the January 6th insurrection marked a turning point in American political protest, according to a leading media and disinformation scholar in Massachusetts. This networked incitement fueled false claims of a stolen election, while rioters coordinated in real time across multiple online platforms. Boston University professor Joan Donovan says the MAGA Republican movement became a weaponized volunteer army directed by tweets from former President Donald Trump.
The problem here was that social media was weaponized against the voting public to plant so many of these egregious stories.
Trump has repeatedly asked his supporters to monitor polling stations and guard the vote this election. Donovan says the social media infrastructure to coordinate those efforts is already being set up online. Donovan points out that the charging and sentencing documents of more than 400 January 6 defendants reveal the majority wanted to support Trump and prevent what he called a rigged election. She's convinced that without greater regulation and penalties for the misuse of social media, popular figures will use disinformation to incite political violence.
These people have learned that the next attempt is going to be much more strategic to prevent election officials from counting votes and certifying those votes.
Donovan says it will take what she calls a whole-of-society approach to counter the dangers of disinformation online. She says government officials and media outlets can use social media to educate the public about the democratic process, and politicians can ensure transparency of donations to political action committees, which often create media disinformation campaigns. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Portland Jewish Voice for Peace activists' protest for a ceasefire in Gaza. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. For tonight's weather, an ice storm warning is in effect until 4 a.m. Wednesday. Freezing rain is expected with an overnight low of 18 degrees. More downed trees and power outages are likely. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a daytime high of 45 degrees, the first time Oregon has seen temperatures above freezing since last week. Today in history, in 1919, Nebraska ratifies the 18th Amendment to the United States Constitution, thereby passing the three-quarters threshold, and prohibition becomes the law of the land 1 year later. The quote of the day is from American writer and critic Susan Sontag, who was born this day in 1933. She said, quote, "Real art has the capacity to make us nervous. By reducing the work of art to its content and then interpreting that, one tames the work of art. Interpretation makes art manageable, conformable." Guatemala has a new president, Bernardo Arevalo. He won the presidency over the summer with strong support from indigenous groups across the country, but it was a long and fraught road to his actual inauguration. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Guatemala has a new president despite efforts by the government system, which tried to prevent Bernardo Arevalo from taking office. He was sworn in this week, elected in August, with heavy support of indigenous groups across the country. But his win was followed by months of electoral drama. Indigenous people have backed the reformists. They even held protests and blockades. Arevalo campaigned in heavily indigenous areas, calling for an end to racism and marginalization of Maya and other indigenous people. In August, Maya anthropologist Irma Alicia Vazquez Nimitu shared perspective. She says indigenous people have high hopes for a different country, where Maya and other indigenous groups are not treated as second-class citizens.
So this is the opportunity to change the reality, to stop the migration to the United States. This is also a special moment for indigenous women. Indigenous women in Guatemala have been working very hard for justice.
In his inauguration speech, Arevalo acknowledged the country's indigenous people. The Associated Press reports indigenous leaders are urging him not to forget about the support they've shown and to keep promises to provide basic needs to their people. For Alaska State Troopers and other police departments across the North, the fur trapper hat is iconic. The State Department of Public Safety buys about 50 of them a year and is looking for a new supply. KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports.
For Alaska State Troopers, the fur trapper hat is more than just head cover.
Our uniform is rich in history.
Austin McDaniel with the Alaska Department of Public Safety says the fur hats have been part of the uniform for decades.
So we're looking for a black hat that's made of otter or beaver fur. A skull cap and ear covers is insulated up to negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
The hats must also be lined with fleece, both windproof and waterproof, and unisex. McDaniel says about half of the troopers prefer to have their hats made locally. Earl Samuelson, a retired trooper from Nipusquiac in southwest Alaska, says after more than three decades with the department, he went through about five hats. He still volunteers with the Bethel Search and Rescue Team, so a good hat is still important.
You got to have a really extreme cold weather hat.
Samuelson is Yupik and says most of his hats, which are called malachayaks, have been made by family, so they fit perfectly. They know that the tiniest leak can lead to frostbite. Samuelson says troopers want that same snug fit, so they often turn to native skin sewers. He also believes the hats are a source of pride for troopers.
People will ask you, well, who made your cap? And you'll say, so-and-so, so-and-so.
Samuelson says most troopers seem to prefer hats made out of sealskin because they're light yet still warm and waterproof. But he believes beaver fur provides the best protection. As for the state, its request for proposals has an unusual provision. It wants prospective hat makers to send two samples subject to a 15-day test. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Cherokee actor Wes Studi is a guest on the PBS television show Finding Your Roots. The episode Fathers and Sons airs Tuesday night with Studi and actor LeVar Burton. Both men grew up without their fathers and have questions about their family trees. Finding Your Roots is in its 10th season, hosted by Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. The show uses DNA technology and detective work to help guests learn about their family's past, often answering decades-old questions, uncovering mysteries, and telling stories of unknown ancestors. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As 2024 takes shape, some married couples might be preparing to go their separate ways. But a new report says that, depending on where you live, it can be hard to predict the outcome of alimony totals approved by courts, creating ripple effects. Mike Moen has more in Madison.
Wisconsin is among the states without a defined formula for deciding alimony payments through divorce court proceedings. A new report says without that predictability, some people might not be getting a fair shake. Custody Exchange, an online firm that helps families navigate divorce, is out with a new analysis of alimony laws across the country. The company Shea Dress says only about a third have a formula on the books. The remaining states, including Wisconsin, essentially give judges discretion to sign off on an amount without a guideline. Settlement agreements often take shape beforehand, but Dress says that's not always the case.
If you can't reach an agreement, because many people who are divorcing aren't on super great terms, and they go to a judge and they say, okay, you decide, what should the alimony amount be? And if that's you going in, you have no idea what to expect.
Dress says this can be especially problematic for those who can't afford an attorney to guide them through negotiations. The report also notes that of the states that do have a formula, only 10 have guidelines for how long payments should continue. The authors recommend implementing policies in states where there are none and for ongoing assessments of existing formulas. Dress says in cases where someone isn't able to secure fair terms, whether that's the person receiving the payments or the other half responsible for them, it can have a lasting effect.
Having bad alimony arrangements can have impact on each of the ex-spouses, on their children, and it can have ripple effects.
That might include housing instability or other forms of financial hardships. Dress says while existing guidelines can help a judge make a decision, there's still flexibility to consider traditional factors such as income levels for both spouses, their ages, and the length of the marriage. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
Political news is everywhere, and while it may be keeping people informed, it also may be making them sick, literally. Research indicates that the nation's social and political divides are leading to added stress, which has serious health implications. Edwin J. Vieira reports from Connecticut.
As beneficial as it is to keep up with current events, too much political news can be detrimental to a person's mental health. Numerous studies are finding increased social divisiveness has contributed to growing stress levels among Americans. An American Psychological Association survey finds concern about the nation's future and social divisiveness are high-ranking stressors. Dr. Jennifer Doran with the Connecticut Psychological Association says there are ways to remain informed while keeping your mental health in check.
I think limiting is really important because obviously it doesn't feel good to be totally disengaged and uninformed, but, you know, too much exposure, especially if we know it's having a negative impact, right, on mood and mental health is not going to be good.
She notes taking some time off from using social media can also help, and it's also a good idea to not watch any political news before bedtime. The challenge of keeping to this is also the problem. While you might use social media to check in with friends and family, articles about politics and current events could be all around, waiting to draw your attention. One thing most studies note is that this trend has only been exacerbated since the 2016 presidential election. As politics grew more pervasive between 2017 and 2020, it came with significant health costs to Americans. And Doran notes the 2020 election did little to alleviate those feelings. She says, for better or worse, politics pervasiveness is permanent.
You know, in our country, especially, there's a very strong sense of you're a Democrat or Republican, and if you're not the thing that I am, you're terrible, right? You're an awful person, you're terrible. It really just creates this, like, in-group, out-group, very, like, dehumanizing mentality for people that is ultimately not helpful.
She cites a prime example of non-political issues becoming politicized as the response to the pandemic. But Doran observes that this tendency didn't start in 2016. It has simply grown since then. This is Edwin J. Vieira for Connecticut News Service.
Last week, the International Court of Justice held public hearings in the case of South Africa versus Israel. South Africa argues that Israel has violated international agreements and committed genocide in the Gaza Strip. The decision has yet to be handed down. One commentator says Israel has done damage to itself in two critical areas: its reputation as the only democracy in the Middle East, and its national security. He says the charges against Israel of genocide will only intensify the damage. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The extraordinary human toll of Israel's military actions in Gaza has prompted charges of genocide under the 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, to which Israel is a party. The crime of genocide, to be clear, includes not just the mass killing of specific groups, but also their forcible relocation and, quote, direct and public incitement to commit genocide. The State of Israel and many prominent Israelis are now being called to answer to these charges, which at bottom puts on trial Israel's twin crises of democracy and security. At year's end, South Africa, though not a party to the Israel-Hamas war, filed a charge of genocide against Israel at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ. The South African charge reads, quote, "The acts and omissions by Israel complained of by South Africa are genocidal in character because they are intended to bring about the destruction of a substantial part of the Palestinian national, racial, and ethnic group." South Africa asked the court to open proceedings, arguing, quote, "Provisional measures are necessary in this case to protect against further severe and irreparable harm to the rights of the Palestinian people under the Genocide Convention, which continue to be violated with impunity," unquote. By provisional measures, South Africa evidently is calling for a ceasefire. The trial began January 11. Israeli officials have angrily denied the charges and pointed out that Hamas's crimes, which they argue amount to genocide, have gone unmentioned. But Israel has decided to defend itself in court for the first time. Whether or not it would comply with a ceasefire decision by the court is very much in doubt, since its provisional rulings are as often ignored as they are obeyed. Just days before South Africa's action, prominent Israelis raised another genocide accusation, this one directed against politicians and other public figures in Israel who speak the language of genocide when urging action against Palestinians. A letter by Israeli academics, former officials, activists, and others to the Attorney General and state prosecutors charged these public figures with incitement to genocide. The letter reads in part, quote, "For the first time that we can remember, the explicit calls to commit atrocious crimes, as stated, against millions of civilians, have turned into a legitimate and regular part of Israeli discourse. Today, calls of these types are an everyday matter in Israel." The lead attorney for the complainant, Michael Savard, contrasts official investigations of people expressing pro-Hamas views with the failure to investigate the public officials, media commentators, and celebrities in Israel who outright call for genocidal actions. Savard says, quote, "It is quite amazing the number of criminal investigations when it comes to Palestinian citizens of Israel, most of them completely anonymous, many of them almost without any audience. The gap between that and the freedom and impunity for those who advocate all kinds of things, ethnic cleansing, killing civilians, bombarding civilian areas, and even genocide, doesn't square up. And that's something for the authorities to explain." To be clear, the letter does not accuse Israel itself of committing genocide in Gaza. The larger significance of these accusations is the harsh light they shine on what Israel has become in just the last few years. The far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu has embraced an exclusivist national identity that undermines the cultural pluralism and democratic values for which Israel once stood. Both the rule of law and the conduct of war have produced a great divide in Israel that may never be overcome, certainly not in the immediate future. A slim majority of Israel's Supreme Court has ruled to retain its rights to intervene in controversial political cases on grounds of reasonableness. The ruling ensures that once the war with Hamas is over, the far right's indifference to the rule of law will be tested, and Netanyahu's future will again be uncertain. The war has deepened the political divide in Israel, not over war strategy, very few people are protesting against the war, but over the incitements to violence and ethnic cleansing directed at Palestinians. The far right's ambition before October 7 was to enlarge Jewish settlements whenever possible and drive Palestinians from their homes and fields. After October 7, its spokespersons, starting with members of Netanyahu's cabinet, had license to conflate anti-Palestinian regulations with overt anti-Palestinian mass violence. I will leave to the International Court to determine if Israel is guilty of genocide within the meaning of the Genocide Convention. What is crystal clear is that Israel is engaging in ethnic cleansing and, like Hamas, is guilty of war crimes. It's often said that democracies don't